Well, let's turn, shall we, to Isaiah chapter 41. I want to look at these first 10 verses. Not the most obvious when you read it through casually. They don't kind of leap out as the most plain and straightforward as so often is the case with Old Testament prophecies. But nonetheless, we don't have to dig that deep. It is there for us. A few weeks back, we were on holiday in East Sussex on the Romney Marshes. And the phone went, and because it's friends of our house, we answered the phone, knowing that it wouldn't be for us. It would be for them, so prepared to say, sorry, it's not our home, and so on. But it was a text message, a pre-recorded message that was coming through. This is a flood alert. And I forget exactly, but anyway, we were warned that there were flood warnings, and to be on the alert. And you think to yourself, what do we do now? And it's been the same this past week, that there's been folk coming on from the Environment Agency saying the ground water is the ground is sodden, waterlogged, be on the alert for floods. And you do think to yourself, well, yeah, but what do you do about it? And I did hear an interview where an interviewer was talking to somebody from the Environment Agency saying just that, well, when you know a flood's coming, what can you do about it? And the chap said quite easily, really, well, there's lots you can do. You can phone in, you can get flood warnings. And I thought to myself, well, I know that. You can get flood warnings, but that doesn't take you any further forward. What do you do about it? And the interview went on, and the best that I got out of it was, well, you can move your papers upstairs. And there's this sense of, you know it's coming, what can you do about it? The Americans on the East Coast, you knew the storm was coming, it had caused devastation in the Caribbean. People were warned, but still 80 deaths. And you can move your stuff, you can flee, but your home is there, your possessions are there, people have their homes taken away, the electricity is still gone, and so on. Now, that's Superstorm Sandy. We know about that. But here is a passage where a devastation is coming, and it's God's warning, if you like. God is sending a warning to the coastlands. And so you'd expect them to get flood warnings, except this isn't really about floods. But this is a warning about something else. What do you do when there is a threat on the horizon and it's on the way? And what you have in this passage is the reality of what happens in humanity, really. There is panic, there is fear, and then you have what should be the response from Israel, the people of God. There should be a quiet trust in God. That all is what he is calling them to. Now, at the time of warning, this is 150 years off. Isaiah is speaking to the people, well, God is speaking to the people through Isaiah, the people of Judah, the southern kingdom, and he is warning them of a threat from the east and the north. Part of the chapter talks about a threat from the east, part of it from the north, sort of sweeping down from the northeast. This is going to be Cyrus. Isaiah will identify him in a couple of more chapters at the end of chapter 44. And God is raising up Cyrus, and Cyrus is going to be the threat. Now, at the time, the children of Israel would be in captivity. And, as I say, this is still some way off. and they would be discouraged and worried for their future. Here they are, miles away from their homeland, cut off as the people of God. Has God forgotten them? What do they do about this crisis that is facing them? And although Cyrus is here, this does kind of stand for a general sense. What do you do when a crisis comes? Not always a natural devastation, but crisis in a family, upheaval, the kind of thing that shakes the routine so that you hit a day that's like no other day you've ever seen. And here are the responses that you get. So first of all, verses 1 to 4. There is this awaiting threat, and this is what is going to come. I'll read those verses again. Keep silence before me, O coastlands. Let the people renew their strength. Let them come near. Then let them speak. Let us come near together for judgment. Who raised up one from the east? Who in righteousness called him to his feet? Who gave the nations before him and made him rule over kings? Who gave them as the dust to his sword, as driven stubble to his bow? Who pursued them and passed safely by the way that he had not gone with his feet? Who has performed and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, am the first, and with the last I am he. Now, right at the end of chapter 40, God has been speaking to the children of Israel and calling upon them to wait upon the Lord. Wait upon the Lord. Trust in him. And those that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. That's a very well known verse. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. So he's talking about renewing their strength. But really, their strength is being renewed by the Lord as they wait upon him. It's not internal. It's not something they work up from within. Now, in verse 1 of chapter 41, God is speaking to the pagans round and about the coastland, the nations of the Mediterranean coast around Israel, not Israel itself. And he's saying, let the people renew their strength. Now you can, he said, work up the strength, because you are about to be called into a court. You are going to face the judge. It reminds me a bit of a select committee hearing where people are brought in and they face the assembled array of the MPs, and there they are at the table. They've got to answer the questions, and the spotlight is on them. The cameras are rolling. But here it is a court scene, and the people are brought in, and God is saying to them, prepare your case, if you like. Take a deep breath. Renew your strength. Get your arguments ready. I want to hear what you're going to do in the face of this calamity, because you have you're answerable to me. It's not just Israel that's answerable to me. All nations answer to the Lord who made them. And although they may not have the light that was given to Israel, yet nonetheless they are answerable to the light that they do have. And so he's calling the coastlands together. There's a little bit of, it's a bit strange, because he says, keep silence before me, O coastlands. And then he says, come, let them come near, then let them speak. I'm not sure, but I'd rather take this perhaps to be keep silent. Keep silent as the charges are read. Well, you can keep silent because you haven't really got anything to say. But, nonetheless, you have an opportunity to speak. So, nations around, nations of the world, facing God, Prepare yourselves, let us come near for judgment, says God. And here is a picture of an overlord who has under his domain vassal states, those that are subject to him, have bowed the knee and have entered into a covenant agreement. And this has happened in our medieval past, where you had a landowner and you had the people under him who would owe allegiance to him and would provide provide men for his army, and he would protect them and so on. But here there's an agreement between the overlord nation and then the vassal nation under them. And if the vassal nation hasn't kept to the terms of the agreement, then they can be summoned. Maybe messengers would be sent and they'd be reminded of the original treaty that took place, they signed. They'd be reminded of the offence, the punishment that would come for breaching the agreement. And it's a reminder of that parable of the vineyard, where the Lord sends out his messengers for the people in the vineyard to give an account. And this is the picture here. It is the kind of thing that would have been very familiar to the people of the time. And here's the question that they would have to answer. Here is somebody, a threat, sweeping in from the east. Who raised this one up? This one is a conqueror. This one sweeps everything before him. The nations just crumble before his marching armies. He rolls them over. He rules over kings. And of course Cyrus the Persian came in and he conquered various nations, Turkey, Afghanistan, and the Persians did sweep through. And they were raised up in righteousness. God, it says there, in righteousness, called into his feet. So there's God saying to Cyrus, come on Cyrus, on your feet. I've got something for you to do. Now interestingly, Cyrus is quite an unusual king. He acknowledged God, right at the very last verse of the book of 2 Chronicles. Cyrus acknowledges that he serves Jehovah. Not as we perhaps would understand that, but nonetheless felt that he was doing something that Jehovah wanted him to do, which was to arrange that the temple be rebuilt. And he allows that. That doesn't mean to say that Cyrus is a man of God. No, he's a bloodthirsty military leader. But nonetheless, there is some acknowledgement of Jehovah, and God in righteousness calls him to his feet. And he is a power as Nebuchadnezzar had been a power, as Alexander the Great would be a power, the Romans, and down through history various powers have been raised up and then put down. Another has been raised up and put down, and here Cyrus is being raised up. To us, to modern Western man, the question would be absurd. You've got a power in China now. China is the great power, isn't it? Or the rising power. And for somebody to go out in the street and say, who has raised up China? Would be laughed at as a question. God, nobody's raised up China. Nobody raised up Stalin or Pol Pot or Hitler or benevolent leaders. They've just kind of entered a vacuum. Perhaps socio-political economic forces have allowed it. But, you know, you don't need to look for somebody outside to have raised them up. Well, here, that is well known that they are not there by himself. Cyrus did not raise himself up. Somebody has done it and has given him great power and speed. Before him, nations are crumbling. He's going so fast. Verse 3, who is it who pursued them and passed safely by the way that he had not gone with his feet? So fast is he marching, his feet aren't touching the ground. He is just whizzing through this land, sweeping all before it. Who has done this? And then you have the answer in verse 4. I, the Lord, am the first, and with the last I am He. I, the Lord, have done this. I am He. Now, I'm not telling you anything new, but it is an opportunity now just to pause and to think of that and think of our situation, and you think of disasters and you think of great powerful movements and what's going on in the world, and just remind ourselves, here is the Lord who sits over it all. I am the first, and with the last I am He. I could take you on a little journey through London, and you could visit Buckingham Palace. Go by Buckingham Palace and you think, this is where the Queen sits, and visitors might well think this is where the Queen rules. And previous monarchs, not so much Buckingham Palace, but Whitehall Palace and other palaces around, have ruled and have been absolute monarchs. And you can think that's where the power is, with royalty, the monarch. You can go to Fleet Street. Not so much now, or to Canary Wharf where the press is, and you could think that's where power is. That's the press barons, they hold power in the nation. Or you could go to Westminster. I think this is Parliament. This is where power is. Or to Whitehall, where the civil servants are, and think they're the ones that really pull the strings. Or you could go to the courts, Royal Courts of Justice, and think that's where the judiciary are. Do they hold the power? Or do you go to the city where the finance is and the big global institutions, and you think that's the power? And then perhaps on your way home you come past a little church where there's a little gathering prayer meeting, just a few believers gather together, and you think that is actually where power is. They are speaking to the God who holds all these things in his hands. They are closer to the power that rules this world than any of these other great buildings and institutions and all they represent. And Isaiah is reminding little Israel, a little bit later on in the chapter, verse 14, fear not, you worm, Jacob. And there's almost something affectionate about that term, you worm. I mean, it's an absolute insult as far as we're concerned, but here's little, minuscule, almost pathetic Israel, so tiny, so easily trodden on, trampled on, laughed at, bearing the name of Jacob, the deceiver, sinful, untrusting, and yet loved by God. And he's reminding little worm Israel, Jacob, Judah, that they are precious in the eyes of God, and that they have a prime place in the purposes of the one who orders this world and directs all its institutions and all its affairs. So there is an important question. Who has raised up this new threat from the east? I, the Lord, am He. now, what about their response? Verses 5 to 7. It's the response of fear. The coastland saw it and feared. The ends of the earth were afraid. They drew near and came. Everyone helped his neighbour and said to his brother, "Be of good courage." So the craftsman encouraged the goldsmith, and he who smooths with the hammer inspired him who strikes the anvil, saying, "It is ready for the soldering." Then he fastened it with pegs, that it might not totter. So here's the reaction. Fear. They saw the threat, and they were quaking in their boots. The ends of the earth were afraid. And they did what people do when there is a threat outside. They unite. They come together. And on a human level, there is something quite endearing about this picture. Everyone helped his neighbour. There is camaraderie in adversity. People gathering together during the Blitz and helping one another out. And there's encouragement. People saying to his brother, "Be of good courage." There's mutual encouragement and strength. Imagine people, probably in America, have been doing this very thing. People have been washed out and others have been joining together to help. You find that kind of neighbourliness. And I don't think this is limited to any one nation. You find that wherever humanity faces this kind of crisis and difficulty, there is coming together. And quite often people will say, it's sad that it's taken this to bring us together. But whenever there's been a horrific sort of crime committed, or somebody's committed something outrageous in the community, people all gather together, all talking together, and they're saying, this doesn't happen here, but they are now coming together. And that's what happens here in the coastlands. But what do they do about it? This mutual help, this camaraderie is all very well. But what does it do? What are they purposing to do together? Well, they're only going to make better, bigger, more, in their view, beautified idols. So, this is how they encourage one another. The craftsmen, the ones who are making the idols, they get them together. And the one who smooths with the hammer inspired him who strikes with the anvil. And they all put their arms around one another and they're getting it all together. They're trusting more in their gods. And you say, why? Your gods have let you down, haven't they? And you're facing a crisis. So what do? Well, you turn more to them. I don't want to make a political point, but it does remind me a little bit of the present situation. We've run into a huge debt, and what's the answer? Well, we should spend more and take on a bit more debt to get out of it. I'm not mocking that, but I'm just saying it's the same kind of thought that you go back to the very thing that you've got into. And here, there is this desire to make a better idol. I don't think they were saying that it's the idol that is the god. That they knew that the idol represented the god, but nonetheless, the two things inevitably become fused together. And Isaiah ends poking a little bit of sarcastic fun at them. It is ready for the soldering, and then he fastens it with pegs, that it might not totter. Because if it totters and falls down, it will never be able to get up again. Because it's a lifeless, useless idol. It's a bit like an IKEA bookcase that comes with a little thing to attach it to the wall. You've got to make it secure so it doesn't fall down. And that is what he is saying to them. This is their response. Now, We can smile at this and think, well, this is very, very far removed from us. But what is our response in a crisis? What do we look for? We don't have a little thing on the mantelpiece that we kind of rub and think that that will help us out. We don't have that, of course. But there are things that we trust, that we immediately look to, that are our, if you like, our, what do we lean on? Do we look for the government to provide an answer? Do we look to our savings to help us out? Do we look to one another to draw inspiration? Or do we turn to the Lord and commit this to Him? That's really what it comes down to. We may not have wooden images, but we do have our own idols, and anything which is not the God of heaven and earth that is our first port of call is really, there's a test here. I remember years ago reading one of the Sherlock Holmes stories, and Sherlock Holmes was in the house where there had been a theft, and he knew that the person in the house had stolen it, but he just didn't know where it was. And he got Watson outside to shout out, "Fire!" And as Watson did that and shouted out, "Fire!" Sherlock Holmes watched the man's eyes, because as soon as he shouted fire, his eyes went to where the stolen thing, I can't remember any more than this, was. That was where his treasure was. And it's our first response, is where do we first look to when disaster comes, we hear something that takes you aback, what's the first response, where do you look? That's a clue to whether you have an idol or whether you have a living trust in God. Well, there we are. Now let's look at the response of the people of God, verses 8 to 10. This is how it should be. "But you, Israel, are my servant, Jacob whom I have chosen, the descendants of Abraham my friend, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from its father's regions, and said to you, you are my servant, I have chosen you, I have not cast you away. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." And here is strong, strong reasons why little puny Judah is not whistling in the dark. It's not just being fanciful and imaginative when it can look at these other nations turning to their idols. Why Israel has a solid hope and a lasting treasure as they look upon their God. God has taken the initiative here. He has chosen them. He has taken them. And you see the way in which he describes them. "Israel, my servant, I've taken you into my pay. You've come within my ambit and my care. You're my servant. Jacob, whom I have chosen, selected, I want you. The descendants of Abraham, my friend." There's this sense of Abraham being the friend of God, and those who are the descendants of Abraham being brought into that friendship. Just another little illustration. There was another program, I don't think I spend all the time watching TV, by the way, but there was a program that was rather moving, and it was different celebrities who traced their fathers back and saw them in the war. And I think this was David Gower. And some of these folk that they focused in the program, had parents or grandparents or uncles who were unsung heroes, did great things in the war. And there were a couple of occasions where the person in question was taken back to people that the relative in question had been with in the war. And the relative just kind of embraced the person. I think this was right with David Gower, that because he had been so closely allied with his father or his uncle, I can't remember which, but the relative, he embraced David Gower for the ancestor and the friendship that he had with him. Now, what the Lord is saying here is, Abraham is my friend. Now, Abraham was the father of faith. If you have the faith that Abraham had, not copying him, but you're a follower of him because your faith is in the promised seed that was promised to Abraham. Your faith is in Jesus Christ. Then you have the faith of Father Abraham. You are brought into the friendship of God. And, like in this program, he embraces you for the sake of Abraham, his friend. Well, and I've taken you from the ends of the earth and called you from its farthest regions. I know that some folk who are into prophecy like to think of this as bringing back physical Israel, but personally I prefer to see this as people who've gone into the remotest parts of the world spiritually. They've gone into dark corners. Not just because that's where geography has taken them, but because morally that's where they've chosen to go. The little lamb that's wandered away from the sheepfold, gone its own way. All we like sheep have gone astray. And here a people had gone to the corners of the earth, deliberately, willfully. And he, in grace, calls them back, calls them from its farthest regions and says, you are my servant, I have chosen you and have not cast you away. You are accepted, you are embraced in the beloved. And here it's repeated, fear not. These are fearful times. God recognizes this. God's promises don't come in a vacuum. They come in the crisis of a situation. And he says, don't fear. You may look out and be fearful, but you don't need to. I am with you. Be not dismayed. I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. And I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Just a final thought on that as we contemplate our own position in this wonderful promise. Some people have kind of taken that and said, well, it really gives me the privilege, the freedom, the liberty to do as I please. No, it doesn't. God says, I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. And we are upheld by one who is righteous. And so he would uphold us in righteousness. So that's not giving us liberty to live as we please, but it's as we seek to serve and please him and be obedient to him. Yes, he will help us. He will uphold us with his righteous right hand. The days may be dark, but he has promised to be with his people, and he will not fail them. May we prove that in our own experience, for his name's sake. Amen.